Hello and welcome to episode 208 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director here at the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, and many other assignments. How are you this week, Bill?
This week, I'm getting better there, Seth. I'll tell you, my wife and I made move number 16 of our married life, and we're approaching our 40th wedding anniversary. And so we're in the new house, and you can imagine there's a bit of an echo in here because I have a room that's dedicated to doing this, but it's not fully set up. But when we moved in, I said, we're going to set up the kitchen so we can eat. We're going to set up our bedroom so we can sleep. But then I need to get the studio put together because I have a podcast to record on Tuesday. And so she wasn't too thrilled about that. But other than the echo, which will resolve as soon as I get the echo dampening stuff in here, some furniture, for example, I'm doing better than I have a right to expect at this point, Seth.
Well, God bless you for moving. As we said last week, it's an unenviable task for anyone. I don't care where you're moving to or from. Mm-hmm. But this week we're going to break down a single mission. This one mission factored heavily in how the remainder of the Pacific War played out in the immediate and long-term future. One mission in which the ultimate revenge, at least on the part of the United States Navy, was issued to the man who orchestrated the attack on Pearl Harbor and who was seen by many within the U.S. military as the main reason the United States was in the war in the first place. That man, of course, was and is Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto. The assassination of Yamamoto, and that is exactly what it was, by the way, was a precisely planned operation that had many moving parts, stretched up the chain, U.S. chain of command, all the way up to FDR, and was set up to be a succeed or fail mission. There was no middle ground. It carried a heavy weight for both the planners as well as those on the receiving end. And while certainly not a turning point sort of event, it was nonetheless important for the reasons that we shall soon see. So, Bill, this is, this is a hit. is what this is. Yeah.
Yeah. We may not have wanted to call it an assassination at the time, but by the legal definition, that's exactly what it was. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say it wasn't justified or righteous or any of those things. But, we can't duck away from the truth here.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's exactly what it was. And we'll get to the moral responsibilities and implications of this as we go through here. But, the target of the entire mission, it stretched all the way up to the chain of command, all the way up to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's desk, was one guy, one cat, and that was Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto. As I said, Yamamoto was the CNC combined fleet. He was a commander-in-chief combined fleet. He was basically the equivalent of Admiral Chester W. Nimitz in the Japanese Navy. And we know a little bit about him, but let's, before we dissect the mission itself, let's talk about Yamamoto. Who was he? What, where did he come from? What were his origins? How did he get to the post in which he was in at this time in April 1943?
The students of Japan will realize that in the 1800s, Japanese discovered that they had fallen behind the rest of the world as it pertained to war fighting, conflict, things like that capability. They were still largely a feudal samurai-led society, as they had been since the 1400s, from the shogunates, things like that in the 1500s and 1600s. And so mid-1800s, they were really starting to migrate away from that towards a more egalitarian society in some respects, but also a more modern military society in others. And those of you who've seen the movie The Last Samurai, great Tom Cruise movie, by the way. In fact, it was one of my late dad's favorite movies, for God knows why he was stationed in Japan during the Korean War. Maybe that's why. Well, remember that movie kind of does span that era where they were moving away from the samurai era. And in fact, one of the main character in that movie that plays the last samurai, Ben Watanabe, I met while working on, I hate to admit this, as technical advisor, naval technical advisor on the movie Godzilla King of Monsters, who he stars in. But anyway, that's a way digression. The point is, Yamamoto was a son of a samurai. And so he really was the first of this new generation of modern military people. He was born in the year 1884, and people think that's a long time ago. My great-grandfather, who was born in 1878, was still alive when I was a boy, and so I knew him. And so Yamamoto, you know, was kind of that generation. In 1901, he entered the Imperial Japanese Naval Academy, graduating in 1904, ranking 11th in his class. So he was, you know, I wouldn't say he was seemed to be an up rising star really early. It really wasn't until the Russian-Japanese War at the turn of the century, just after he graduated from the academy, when his star did start rising. Right, Seth?
Right. Yeah, he was in the Battle of Tsushima Straits in the Russo-Japanese War, and he actually was wounded there. He lost, two fingers on his left hand. He lost two fingers on his left hand, and that was something. In some pictures of him, which there aren't, surprisingly, there's not a whole lot of pictures of Yamamoto. I mean, there's a few, and we'll show obviously a few here, but there's not as many as you may think. And in some of those early pictures, you do see the missing fingers on his left hand. So, I mean, you know, he wasn't just another naval officer that hadn't seen any kind of combat, you know, in those pre-World War II days. He had seen plenty, and he had, you know, as you say, Bill, had started to rise to the top of the crop. In terms of post-war, and by post-war, I mean post-Russo-Japanese War, pre-World War II Imperial Navy era. He rose through the ranks, eventually taking camp command of the Japanese aircraft carrier Akagi. And obviously, anybody who's watching the show knows what Akagi did. She was a flagship at Pearl Harbor and Midway, where she was finally sunk. He was an early proponent. He was one of the few, and I mean very few, Japanese officers in pre-World War II area IJN that was a proponent of naval aviation. You know, we've talked about this ad nauseum on the show, that the Japanese, even though they were the masters of naval aviation in 41-42, they were still a big gun navy. They were still the proponents of the, you know, Kantai Kessen, the whole, you know, climactic fleet battle, bringing their battleships into range and shooting us up and all that jazz. Yamamoto was a proponent of the newfangled naval aviation, and that actually got him a lot of enemies in the pre-war Japanese Navy, you know, because he pissed off a lot of battleship admirals, and essentially. As we'll see as we go through this little discussion on him, he made a lot of enemies that almost cost him his life. When the United States and Japan were, the tensions were kind of starting to build. Japan had seen, and even before then, really, Japan had seen the United States as their primary potential future enemy. And Yamamoto had spent a lot of time in the U.S., didn't he, Bill? I mean, he wasn't just some Japanese admiral who didn't know, you know, anything about the United States. He was an admirer of the United States and the West in general, but he'd spent a lot of time here, right?
He saw the United States as a rising power, particularly at the end of World War I. Remember, the United States was the second and third class military around the time of the Spanish-American War. Our star started rising during World War I, when we were able to amass a fairly large force and ship it off to Europe and fight effectively. Well, he came to the United States to study at Harvard in 1919, you know, right at the end of World War I. And really saw how the United States was able to do what it did during the war. He was at Harvard from 1919 to 1921, touring the country extensively. He really wanted to learn a lot about this new country. Again, when Japan said that we're going to become modern, because the late 1800s, the predominant premier modern military in the world, particularly as it pertains to Navy, was the United Kingdom, not the United States.
Right.
And so most Japanese were Anglophiles to the extent they're modeling their navy after Britain. Mm-hmm. When Yamamoto toured the United States, he started thinking, you know what? I think we're focused on the wrong country. both from geopolitical reasons that Britain is not a real Pacific power. The United States can be a real Pacific power. And the United States military might and industrial might has a potential to way outclass Britain. He started saying, that's the country I want to emulate, not the United Kingdom. And started becoming as close to an Americanophile as you could have in the Japanese army and navy and not get assassinated.
Yeah, totally. And he, you know, the one thing when he toured the United States and, you know, he went to Harvard, like you said, and for a couple of years and everything, he toured the U.S. And at that time, you know, the United States was a massive industrial power. And by that, I mean, we, the country, produced the vast majority of global goods that were consumed across the globe. Unfortunately, that's not such the case today. But regardless, in this time period, it was. And he noticed that. And every time he'd see something, be it a steel factory or, you know, Ford factory in Detroit or whatever it was, he continually made that mental note that, you know, we being the United States, had these massive, you know, natural resource pots everywhere all over this country that Japan did not, you know, and he continually made mental notes of that, is that, you know, this country, the United States, had this vast industrial power, yes, but we also had natural resources that his country never could have naturally without invading and conquering other lands. So he was fully aware of the fact that if his country ever did go to war with our country, with the United States, that it would be probably not something that would end well in a long-term attritional war. And we've talked about this a lot, but he was, you know, he gathered that information by touring this country firsthand. And he was, to that end, he also knew that if Japan did act upon its intentions and wishes of expanding and becoming an empire into itself, that we, being the United States, would react probably, you know, negatively to that end. And so, therefore, Yamamoto was against the Japanese invasion of Manchuria in 31. He was against the war with China in 37, because he knew that eventually, you know, enough is going to be enough and it's going to irritate this country and we're going to do something about it, which, of course, we did. He was also against the fact that Japan signed the tripartite.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
No worries.
With Nazi Germany and Italy, because he also knew that if Japan does that, it's going to put us on the United States's, you know, bad list, if you will, naughty list. And that's exactly what happened. He was such an outspoken critic of all these events, you know, Manchuria, China, the alliance with Nazi Germany and Italy, that he actually did become a target for assassination within the Japanese military system.
Yeah, you know, people think of the Japanese imperial military as being these very compliant, very deferential to the emperor people who will follow orders at all costs. And in fact, yeah, there was an assassination plot against Yamamoto in 1945, of course, very famously. There's an assassination plot against the emperor himself. So these were not people who just kowtowed without thinking about it. They absolutely believed the times that they needed to take matters into their own hands. And Yamamoto suffered. And it's interesting because he didn't oppose the invasion of Manchuria in Japan because he believed they were morally wrong, or that Japanese wasn't the Japanese weren't superior to these other races. He believed, just like most Japanese did, that Japanese were superior to these other races. He believed that he was opposed to it on practical terms, because he knew, unlike the United States, Japan needed to import all these resources necessary to fight the war, and that the United States eventually would have the power, should they choose to do so, to stop that importation. And so that was very practical, his opposition, not idealistic. It was, so he wasn't a great grand lover of peace by any means, as it turns out. As we all know, he came up with a plan on how to attack Pearl Harbor.
Sure.
So when ordered, he was absolutely willing to do it. but he was also very vocal in his opposition and his belief that should Japan to go down this path, we would have to win a quick victory or things would go badly for us.
Exactly. And that's exactly why Pearl Harbor was Pearl Harbor, is that, you know, to your point, he knew that Japan needed to attack the United States, knock us out, and then bring us to the negotiating table. He knew that any kind of war of, you know, attritional war was going to end poorly for his country. His initial plan for Pearl Harbor was rejected. You know, so let me back up one step before we get to this. He was held in extremely high regard within the Imperial Navy. The Imperial Army did not think so highly of him, but the Imperial Navy did. And that's why he was made commander. Well, that's one of the reasons he was made commander in chief. The other reason was, is that as commander in chief, he would theoretically be at sea and therefore would be less likely to be assassinated. But that's, you know, anyway, he was loved by everybody who served underneath. Well, most everybody that served underneath him, you know, he was hugely popular. He was a sports hero, superhero within the Japanese, you know, the public's eye. And we'll talk about that
in that regard. It was very Halsey like in that regard.
More so, maybe, honestly. Yeah. You know, I think he was even more so of a hero to the Japanese people than Admiral Halsey was, because, you know, we had a lot of admirals that were making the headlines in 43, 44, and 45. The Japanese had one, and he was it. You know, and after Pearl Harbor, you know, they lionized him for obvious reasons. But what I started to say is that before Pearl Harbor, his initial plan for the attack on the harbor was rejected. And he figured that, you know, my country's going down this road to war with the United States. I don't want to do this. I think this is going to end poorly. This is the only way I know how to win this war, or at least, you know, make it, you know, come out in Japan's favor. And if you guys don't do it my way, I'm going to resign. Here's my paper. I'm going to resign. I am out. And that's not the only time he did this. He did it at Midway too, or for Midway, but this was the important one. And ultimately, obviously, the Imperial Navy did say, yeah, okay, yeah, fine. We'll use your plan there, Isoroku. Let's get this done. So, you know, we know what happens next. So we're not necessarily going to cover all that again. We've done that already. But, you know, I think after Pearl Harbor, after the initial Japanese run across the Pacific in those 6 months where they were just wiping everybody off the slate up until Midway, and even after Midway, you know, the Japanese people, and this is something that I wanted to talk about, they held him up on a pedestal where probably no other Japanese officer, be it Army or Navy, had ever been put before, with the exception of Admiral Togo, maybe. And they absolutely adored him. He used to get fan mail from the Japanese citizenry, that he would personally answer. He'd write letters back. Mm-hmm. Sent autographed pictures of himself, all kinds of stuff. He was literally, you know, like a movie star in Japan when, you know, at a time when they weren't really doing that kind of thing in Japan. But, you know, history has painted him in a picture of being this naval genius. And you know, as we've seen in all the episodes we've done so far, we've talked about the decisions he made Midway, that history looks at him in a different light now, don't we, Bill?
Yeah, you know, he turns out he wasn't very good at all.
No.
And this is one of those things that I'm not sure. I mean, there are many historians who have worked to correct the record on Yamamoto's proficiency. But he got one thing right, and that was if Japan didn't win quickly, this wasn't going to go well for them. That's grand strategy. Military strategy, next level down, okay, now if we're going to win quickly, how do we do that? And then operational art, one level down below that, he was horrible at, as it turns out.
Yeah.
He really didn't understand the strategic significance of the chess moves that he himself was making.
Right.
And he got outmaneuvered by Nimitz time after time after time. And it to the point where one wonders, if the Japanese Navy was better with him or without him.
Yeah.
In other words, did we, when we made the decision to try to assassinate him, and we'll talk about how that came about in a minute, was that the right move from a victory standpoint, or was he going to be the anchor that dragged the Japanese Navy down more quickly? Was his ideological, or his, the hero worship, the destruction of that hero worship as it pertains to him, and the creation of a martyr, in essence, mm-hmm. by assassinating him, did that hasten the war's end, or did allowing him to keep making strategic blunders, would that have hastened the war's end? It's great discussion point. We'll never know which is better.
And to that end, I want to talk about that when we get through all this stuff on this particular mission, because I agree with you. I think that's a fascinating point to discuss. But, you know, if you go back to what you were saying, you go back to your point, Bill, you know, I mean, Midway is on him. Yeah, I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. you know, we all know the story, you know, 4 minutes, the tide of the, you know, the tide of that battle changed into a victory for the United States. But I mean, he's the reason that they were there, you know, that was his plan. And yeah, there was a lot of luck involved in Midway, no doubt, no doubt. But Guadalcanal, you look at Guadalcanal, which was the turning point in the Pacific War. You look at that and you look at all these actions that are being fought, you know, from Savo to Santa Cruz to whatever. That's mm-hmm. him pulling the trigger on that. And not to say that he shouldn't have done it, but, you know, we talked about this when we did our Guadalcanal series, is that, you know, he didn't always throw everything at the table. He'd throw things piecemeal, little penny packets here and there. He'd never throw it all at the table. And he just
violated the principle of war called mass.
Yeah.
You know, so he was a proponent of Alfred Thayer Mahan to the extent that he sought that decisive battle. But in every case where he sought the decisive battle, he withheld forces to the extent that victory was never assured.
Right.
If you're going to seek the decisive battle, you better win.
Yeah.
And that's the part he kept screwing up.
Constantly. Constantly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, through the lens of history, you know, most people say that he was a great admiral. He was a great strategist and all this jazz. He was on par with Lord Nelson, which, man, it's not even close. It's not even close. But in the eyes of the Japanese, he was, you know, on par with Lord Nelson. And at times in 1942, you know, in 1943, I wouldn't say that he was on par with Nelson, but, you know, his own enemies, the United States, looked at him as the main reason for Japan's success. And to an extent, you know, mm-hmm. we were right. So that being said, let's get to the mission. In April 1943, U.S. cryptanalysts, specifically Station Hypo, and you all know about Station Hypo. These are Joseph Rochefort's people under, you know, Edmund Layton. You know, they're all out there. These are the people in Pearl Harbor. Yeah, that are mm-hmm. trying to break Japanese code. By 1943, Hypo had deciphered a great deal of the Japanese naval code JN-25. And you got to remember, the Japanese changed bits and pieces of their code about every 5 to 6 months. So even if we were reading it, you know, or reading most of it, you know, a few months later, blam, they'd change it and we'd have to start working all over again. However, every 6 to 9 months, the Japanese would change their code. But there was a partial lapse in the beginning of 1943 into April where the Japanese, for whatever reason, did not change their code. So by April 1943, we were really
They couldn't get the new codes out to everybody who needed them in time.
Yeah.
So they had to delay rolling out the new code because, you know, they failed logistically.
Yeah. So and by April 43, which is our time period now, Layton's people there at, you know, in Pearl Harbor and Station Frumel in Melbourne are practically, they're not reading every word, but they're reading about 85% to 90% of the Japanese messages that are being sent through. So it is very, very dangerous for the Japanese to send any, and of course they have no idea, but it's very dangerous for them to send anything because we're reading dang near everything that comes out.
Now, let's be precise on this though, because we had the capability to read everything that came out. We didn't have the capacity to read that everything that came out. And that goes through 1945. We were receiving a lot of messages that we could decipher, but didn't have the time or people to decipher. So we focused on the ones that had certain codes in them that we knew related to people like Admiral Yamamoto.
Exactly.
And so we saw a message in with Admiral Yamamoto's trigraph, or code, meaning this is from him or to him, or info him, that one would get precedence and we would break it. But there were dozens of, if hundreds of messages that would go into the inbox, that we'll get to those when we can get to them. But we knew which ones we needed to read first, and this was one of those.
Exactly. And Edwin Layton had mentioned post-war that they knew exactly Yamamoto's code or code word or code name or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. They knew exactly. So whenever anything like that would come through, bam, that was, you know, immediate attention. And that's exactly what happens here. Hypo was fully aware that Admiral Yamamoto was in Rabaul in April of 1943. They knew he was there. They knew why he was there. They just didn't know exactly what he was going to do next until they deciphered the message that leads to the mission that we're going to talk about. The reason that Yamamoto was in Rabaul at this time in April 1943, we're not going to get into the weeds in this too much because that could be potentially a whole nother episode. He was there to personally direct and oversee Operation IGO. IGO was an aerial counteroffensive against American possessions in Guadalcanal and New Guinea. That was somewhat successful. Of course, you know, the Japanese are looking for this almighty, you know, turning point, Kantai-Kessin climactic battle. It did not achieve those results. It did achieve some success, but obviously, you know, we still have Guadalcanal and New Guinea. Hypo intercepted and decoded a message that stated on April 11th, Yamamoto had issued a directive that he would make a tour of the area bases in the Northern Solomons. When Hypo read this, it sent off alarms all the way up the chain of command. His tour route would be Buin, Balail, and Shortland Island air bases, with the departure date set for April the 18th. Yamamoto's staff gunnery officer, Captain Watanabe, had Yamamoto's itinerary radioed via Navy frequency to the appropriate locales on April 13th.
This is one of those military things where you try to tell the people that the Grand Admiral is going to be visiting you. Be prepared, mm-hmm. and don't embarrass us. That's the kind of message that would have gone to them.
Yeah.
You know, for he may expect, do not embarrass us. And of course, from an operational security standpoint, it's a stupid kind of message to send.
Big time. Yeah. They're basically saying, hey, you know, the chief is coming to cut the grass and pull the weeds. He's going to be here at mm-hmm. this time. And the message read, and I quote, quote, on 18 April, CNC Combined Fleet will visit RYZ, R and RXP in accordance with following schedule. Number one, depart RR at 0600 in a medium attack plane escorted by 6 fighters. Arrive at RYZ at 0800, proceed by minesweeper to R, arriving at 0840. Well, what is R? We knew what all
this. Precise.
Yeah, it's exact. it's ridiculously precise. And we already knew what R, RYZ, and all this stuff already meant. We knew that RR was Rabaul, RXZ was Balail, and RXP was Buin. So we knew exactly where he was going to be at exactly the time, the aircraft that he was going to be flying in, the direction in which he was coming. You know, it set it out on a silver platter for Hypo to read and decipher.
And one of the differences with our podcast and others is we like to name names, and code breakers, Tommy Dyer and Ham Wright, those are the names for you, are the ones who deciphered these messages. And so credit to them, and they're, you know, hopefully one of their family members is listening, because that initiated the sequence of events that's about to transpire.
Mm-hmm. Dyer and Wright were able to decipher the message that was sent to the garrison commander at Balail too. And so that meaning that making it clear that Yamamoto's flight would place him in range at that point, albeit extreme range, of Guadalcanal. And, you know, we talked about
not
Guadalcanal
for Navy airplanes, right? Yeah.
Correct. No, not for Navy airplanes. The range of Navy airplanes at that time was still very limited. The farthest airplane they could fly was the Corsair, which was just now starting to operate out of Guadalcanal, but it didn't even have the range with belly tanks. It could not make it out there. The only airplane that could was the P-38.
There wasn't a bomber.
Right. That yeah. wasn't exactly. P-38. That wasn't a bomber. Yeah. It was a P-38 Lightning.
This ended up being about a 500 mile tactical radius mission. It was a round trip about 1,000 miles.
It was exactly, almost exactly 1,000 miles. The outward leg, and we'll get to that in a second. The outward leg was about 600 and the return leg was 4. Why? And we'll talk about that in a second. But it was at that time, theoretically, was going to be the longest, the farthest range fighter intercept mission of the war. And that's exactly what it was going to be. The following morning after this radio message was broken, and by following morning, I'm talking like, 0200. It wasn't at like 9. Hey, let's just wait. No. Dawn broke. Really? Yeah. Jasper Holmes, who operating there in Station Hypo, he called Layton and asked what his opinion was regarding action. In other words, hey, we just intercepted this. This is exactly the plan for this guy. Here's his itinerary. We know everything. What do you think we ought to do? And Layton goes to Nimitz. And Nimitz, I think if he'd have gone to Halsey immediately, it would have been a different reaction. But Nimitz had bit of reservation, right?
Said, you bet.
Yeah. But Nimitz did not,
no
did
question
he?
What we did. Yeah. Yeah. If it was Hitler on that plane, would we go after him?
Yeah.
Of course we would. And so the question becomes, okay, now how's Yamamoto different from Hitler? Yamamoto attacked the United States, We didn't know everything that Hitler was doing at that point in the war yet. But of course, we would have gone after both. But they still raised it up the flagpole to King, and King brought it to Sekhnav, and Sekhnav brought it to FDR and said, hey, look, is this legitimate? We didn't want to get a read on this.
Yeah. And it carried some significant weight, moral weight, to these guys. It was, yeah, they were the enemy. Yamamoto was the enemy. But, Chester Nimitz and Franklin Roosevelt also viewed him as, a contemporary. He was Nimitz's equal. He was the same kind of guy. He was the same. He held the same kind of sway,
And Layton almost thought of him as a friend. I mean, Layton knew him pretty well from the time that Layton served in Japan.
Right.
More than met him, he interacted with him a great deal. Yeah. So here's Layton asking, hey, look, I know this guy, I know he kind of likes America. Maybe this isn't so good. And of course, Nimitz questioned Layton, you can anticipate, if we do kill him, who's going to replace him? Mm-hmm. Is the person who's going to replace him going to be worse? And I think Layton said something like, really nobody in line to replace him. There's nobody with that amount of panache,
right?
Or
exactly
sobriety or whatever word you want to use, that will carry the same weight, whose opinion will carry the same weight with the general and naval staff and the prime minister as Yamamoto. Right. And so that kind of made it more likely that they were going to do this.
Nimitz had, he asked Layton, according to Layton's memory post-war, Nimitz asked Layton, he says, do we try and get him? And because Nimitz, this is, yes, it's the enemy, but this is also, that brotherhood of officers kind of thing here. And you could speak to that far better than I, but Nimitz had qualms about this. He's like, this is a hit. This is an assassination. This is not something that we generally do. To which Layton then said, well, if you were on that plane, they would do the same thing to you.
They would shoot you down. Absolutely.
and to which Nimitz, he still kind of teeter-tottered on it. And Layton apparently told him, to your point, Bill, he said, there's nobody that can replace this guy, much like you, Admiral Nimitz. Right. So, if we take him out, this is going to be a huge hole that's going to be left in the Imperial Navy's command structure.
Yeah. And King and FDR basically agreed and greenlit the operation. Then you're struck with the problem. Okay, so how do we do this? Mm-hmm. We're gonna have to be at a precise point at a precise time. How do we do this and still maintain operational security and not give away the secret that we're reading their mail? Mm-hmm. What cover story do we put out there that explains how we were able to be right there at that moment.
Right.
And they decided to go with the story that since, because these airplanes essentially flew down what we were already calling the slot, mm-hmm. within visual range of these islands, all the way down towards Guadalcanal, towards Bougainville. And so the cover story was developed that it was Australian coast watchers. The secret was already out that we had a bunch of Australian coast watchers on, sure. these islands. The Japanese were already looking for them. So it was Australian coast watchers who saw unidentified airplanes. And it was, the story is not going to be, this is Yamamoto's airplane. These are Japanese airplanes. Being Japanese airplanes, we are right to try to shoot them down. So that became the cover story. And initially, only a very limited number of people were given the need to know that Yamamoto is going to be on this airplane. And then only a few eyes-only messages were sent to those handful, I'm talking less than five, mm-hmm. people who had the need to know that this was going, we were going after Yamamoto.
Yep. That eyes-only message that you're referring to was sent to Admiral William F. Halsey, of course. And Halsey, to your point, he was apprehensive. He, not about killing Yamamoto. He was like, oh, yeah, that's fine. Cool. Let's go get him. But he was also very concerned that our cover would be blown, that we were reading their mail. So to your point, exactly. Yeah, they Halsey was instructed by Nimitz to say an Aussie coast watcher saw these guys. But Halsey, to be abundantly clear, was perfectly willing and ready to go get Yamamoto. He had no qualms about shooting him down whatsoever. So all this stuff goes down fast. Boom, 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 boom. You know, they break the code, or they break the code. They break the message they deciphered on April 13th or April 14th. It all goes up the chain. It comes right back down on April 17th. It's formally approved. So, I mean, this is just a few days. Pow, 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 pow. It comes through. The operation was given the code name Vengeance, Operation Vengeance. The Navy felt so strongly about the role that Yamamoto had played in the war to this point that they were the ones that named this operation Operation Vengeance for obvious reasons. Yeah. You know, that Yamamoto inflicted such pain and devastation on the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor specifically that they wanted payback. So the Navy as a whole, I don't think had any qualms at all about pulling the trigger on this.
Now, remember, this flight was going to take place on April 18th, mm-hmm. and formal approval wasn't received until April 17th. Now, that doesn't give you a lot of time because it takes many hours to fly that 600 miles. Right. So the planes have to take off, you know, many hours before the flight's going to be at that intercept point over Bougainville. So soft planning began prior to formal approval being received.
Right.
And once formal approval was received, then the real hard planning, this pilot, this airplane, this, you know, intercept point, that began, you know, in to get cemented as soon as the formal approval was received on the 17th, the day before they had to fly.
Yep. And to that end, you know, we were talking about the range. It was just a shade over 1,000 miles round trip. It was the longest range fighter intercept mission of the war to that point. P-38G, as in Gulf Lightnings, were chosen to fly that because they were the only ones that had the legs. And even they didn't necessarily have the legs until they equipped the 38s with the drop tanks. And several of them, too, for that matter. Even with the addition of the drop tanks, they would just barely have the range to get out there, do their thing, and get back. There would be no dogfighting. If they were to intercept the Japanese, they were going in there, hitting and running and gone. There would be no tangling and, you know, farting around. They're going to hit and they're gone because they might not get home because they're going to be sucking fumes when they're flying over Guadalcanal.
Right. And these were Army Air Forces planes out of the 339th Fighter Squadron. Mm-hmm. And even though they were fighters, we had intel that the Admiral was going to be in a medium bomber, like most likely a Betty. Mm-hmm. And so they were going to go kind of straight at that Betty. And the only thing they're going to do in tangling with zeros is to keep the zeros off the planes that were going to be assigned to shoot down the Bettys.
And to that end, there was one man that was chosen to arrange all of this stuff. His name was Major John Mitchell of the 339th. He was selected to lead the mission. Mitchell was a Mississippi native, born in Enid, Mississippi, joined the Army in 1934. 38, he was selected for flight training and had logged thousands of hours by the time of Operation Vengeance. As a matter of fact, he was already a fighter ace. He'd had 8 kills to his credit. He was considered easily one of the most experienced and skilled aviators in this region. And we're talking about Guadalcanal. I'm not talking about Richard Bong and you know, all those guys that were flying up in New Guinea. I'm talking about Guadalcanal specifically. I mean, Mitchell had a ton of hours. His flight would consist of 18 aircraft. So we're not messing around here. We're sending, you know, if we're doing it, we're doing it right. 18 aircraft, of which 4 would be assigned as the killer group. And that's exactly what they called them, the killer group. These 4 pilots would attack the Betty bombers only. And after they were down, would engage whatever fighter aircraft were in their field of vision, just so we could get out and extricate ourselves from this situation. Because it was widely assumed that if we attack the Bettys, they're going to be escorted. We already knew that we're going to be escorted. The escorts are going to come down. We're going to engage them just as long as we have to, so we can beat feet and go home.
Exfil.
Yeah. The remaining 38s for the remaining 14 would fly top cover for the 4 in the killer group. And they would, if need be, fight off the Zeros that would come and attack the killer group, and also act as fill-ins too, if anybody got shot down. Just before, you know, late on the night of the 17th, early morning 18th, Marine Major John Condon provided a flight plan to Mitchell. Now, Condon, God bless him, he worked it up based off of, you know, what limited knowledge he had on the range and the ability of the P-38. And he also based a lot of his flight planning on the range and the ability of the F-4U Corsair, which, of course, is fine, but they're not flying Corsairs. Mitchell, to his credit, you know, he looked at the flight plan and he said, thank you very much. And then he turned around and tore it up and he says, this ain't gonna work. In Condon's face, very, very, you know, politely, but he was like, thank you, appreciate your effort, but I got this. Mitchell sat there, he called in the rest of his pilots, well, the vast majority of his pilots that were flying the mission, and they all together sat there in basically a school circle and planned the flight plan literally down to the minute, because it had to be exactly precise. They had to intercept Yamamoto at the precise place at the precise time so they could get home. That was the ultimate goal, of course, is to get home. He called on several of the members, including one guy you're going to hear about, a lot about here in just a minute, is Rex Barber. They worked out the precise plan that would put Mitchell's flight above the supposed point of intercept at 0935. It was thought that if Yamamoto flew the prescribed route at the prescribed speed, everything that the Japanese had laid out, he would be at this spot at 0935. So Mitchell planned to have his people there at precisely that moment.
Now, the most vulnerable point is when he's making final approach to land. And of course, that was the target, right? So they knew where the runway was. Mm-hmm. So if they can get to that point, you knew what the approach vector would be. If you can hit him when he's final approach, he's going to be very vulnerable because he's slowing. And so that's the time. So you can imagine with 1943 tools, with windage charts and things like that, they're planning this mission down to the minute, to get a single airplane on final approach at a specific minute. And we've got to plan our route out to them to make sure that we hit that place, not too early, because we don't want to tangle with the fighters before the Betty gets there, and not too late, because then the Betty's on the ground. And what do we do now? You're exactly right. You know, this is a miracle of precise mission planning.
It was just brilliant work by Mitchell, frankly. I mean, the fact that he, as you said, was able to precisely counter all this to the exact minute with pencil and paper is just, it's incredibly impressive. On the outward leg of the flight, the outward leg would be 600 miles. The return leg would be 4. Why? Because the 38s were basically going to fly a dog leg into the route area to avoid any kind of detection by roaming Japanese patrols. They were also going to fly at wave top height, about 50 feet off the water, which is incredibly low in a P-38, to avoid any possible radar detection by the Japanese. So, I mean, this was down, you know, and they obviously maintained radio silence, but this was down to, you know, the exact instance of everything. It was so highly planned and coordinated. To cover their code-breaking ruse that Nimitz instructed Halsey to tell, the pilots were told that the Aussie Coast Watcher had seen a high-ranking naval officer boarding a flight at Rabaul. They did not say, theoretically, hold on, we'll get to this in a second, they did not say who. Many histories have said that the pilots who were taking part in this mission did not know that it was Admiral Yamamoto. That is completely 100% false. They knew that it was Admiral Yamamoto that they were going after. They were told that for two reasons. One, mainly to basically hype them up that, like, we have to get this guy. Oh, we know who this cat is. He's the guy that attacked Pearl Harbor. We're going to get him, and we're going to get him right now. So anytime you've ever read that they didn't know that it was Yamamoto in this flight, that's malarkey. They knew exactly, and we're going to get to some specific radio traffic that talks about this here in a second. At 0725 on April 18th, the 38s took off from Guadalcanal. They took off from Fighter 2 at Kukum. Dave Holland will hear this and give me a thumbs up because that's, you know, hey. Hey, Dave.
Right.
But immediately, almost immediately after the 38s took off, two of the four killer group had malfunctions. One had a flat tire on takeoff. One had engine trouble with his fuel system after he'd gotten airborne, and two of the four immediately had to turn back. So Mitchell assigned Besby Holmes and Raymond Hine to the already assigned Thomas Lanfear, Captain Thomas Lanfear, and Lieutenant Rex Barber to the killer group. So now the killer group's got two different guys at it. Regardless of that, it doesn't matter. Everybody had been briefed on the exact same type of mission. Everybody knew exactly what they were supposed to do.
Yeah, the other two pilots were in the high group, mm-hmm. so they knew the answer to the mission. They just got transposed into the killer group.
Mm-hmm. The weather was crystal clear. It was a perfect day for flying. You know, ceiling was virtually unlimited. It had a very, very high ceiling. You know, the weather was could not, if you'd have ordered weather for an intercept mission, you would have ordered this type of weather. You know, it was just beautifully clear.
The pilot's expression is KVU. Ceiling and visibility unlimited.
And that is precisely what this was. Mitchell's flight plan and execution was absolutely perfect. We talked about how much he put into the plan. His flight arrived on scene at 0934. 1 minute early.
Yeah, dude, do it better next time, dude.
Yeah, I swear. I mean, it's incredible. It really is. It's absolutely incredible.
And, you know, puts this in perspective. When I was, you know, in submarines, we would plan Tomahawk missile strikes using time on target, TOT, and, you know, have multiple Tomahawks hit the exact point offset by a few seconds so they didn't do fratricide. And we would be good if we did 1 minute off of the mission plan TOT. So, I mean, these guys are flying very rudimentary, very manual, rough wind speeds, you know, kind of, and they still do it. This is remarkable.
Yeah, it's awesome is what it is. So when they arrive on the scene, you know, 1 minute early at 9:34 as opposed to 9:35, they start looking around. Mitchell starts looking around and he doesn't see them. He doesn't see the Bettys. He doesn't see the Japanese flight. They're nowhere to be seen. He starts to panic. And then literally about 30 seconds later, one of his pilots, and I do not know who, one of his pilots called bandits 11 o'clock high. Because you got to remember, they're 50 foot off the water. And Mitchell looks up and sure enough.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
You know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say Mitchell looks up and he sees the flight starting their initial descent into Belleau. At that moment, boom, the 38s jettison their drop tanks. And it's on. He gives the orders to Lanfear, the killer group. He tells the killer group, you know, assume positions and go after him. And this throws right, the
Tom,
whole
go get him.
Yeah.
That's what he said to Lanfear.
Exactly. And this throws the whole thing. Oh, they didn't know Yamamoto was in there. Baloney. The radio traffic says that they did because Mitchell says to Lanfear, go get him, not go get them, go get him. Yeah. So they knew exactly who was in that bird. As Barber, so the two additional killer group again had mechanical issues. They couldn't drop their jet tanks. They could not jettison their drop tanks, and therefore were not able to initially join the flight of four to go get the two Bettys. And that's when Mitchell said, "You and Barber, just go get them." Barber and Lanphier climbed towards the flight of eight enemy aircraft. The escorting Zero saw them drop their drop tanks and immediately turned into the P-38s. The P-38s are now making a head-on interception on the Zeros and the Bettys. Lanphier radios to Barber and says, "You go get the Bettys. I'll deal with the Zeros." Lanphier heads directly at the Zeros, firing the entire way in, and basically scatters them like a flock of ducks. So the Zeros are poof. They're there, and you know, a couple of them get hit, but they're all flying around in the air, and then you know it becomes a melee really quick. As Barber closed in on the Bettys, now Rex Barber, this is Rex Barber, one push downward, hoping to get even lower because they're now in a landing pattern. They're descending. One Betty, he's flooring the fire. He's throwing the throttle to the firewall and getting down low so he can come in and hopefully get on the ground, because it's very apparent what's about to happen to this Japanese pilot. When he does this, one of the Bettys crosses right in front of Barber's windscreen. It surprised Barber in that he wasn't able to open fire at that point. He rolls over, basically inverted on his back. And when he does so, he comes right back around and he's sitting directly on the tail of this Betty. I mean, directly behind it. Literally the perfect spot to open fire. And that's exactly what he does. If you remember, Bill, when we did our Cactus Air Force episode, we talked about, you know, several of the Marine fighter pilots would get so close that the joke was they'd leave powder burns.
From the paint. Yeah.
Right.
Right. Powder burns.
Yeah. Rex Barber apparently took notes. He got so close to the Japanese Betty that when he opened fire, pieces of it were flying off and hitting his P-38.
And hitting.
Yeah. I mean, he was right up the tail of this thing. As he's opening fire and hitting this Betty, Lanphier, now having scattered the Zeros, he rolls back over and he's coming in to attack this Betty, this other Betty, the one that Barber's attacking from the right-hand side of the airplane. He fires from a long way off because he can see the target. He knows what his target is. He fires from a very long distance, and there's controversy as to
dangerous.
Yeah.
Since Barber is so close, right?
Right.
It's they threw all risk to the wind at this point.
Yeah, this is an all or nothing gamble here. This is a, you know, do or die mission, literally. Barber could see his round striking the right engine and the right rear fuselage of the Betty. As he's
fuselage, remember that.
Yep, and this is important. As he's watching this, the Betty just, whoa, it violently whips over to the left, causing Barber to pull up because he almost ran into it. He was that close that when the Betty, it started to lose power and just immediately violently flipped over, Barber had to give it the goose and just pull it up because he was about to run into this thing. As he pulls up, he looks back down and he watches this Betty careen into the jungle below, kabloom, and just explodes. Leaves a big black column of smoke in the jungle. Unbeknownst to Barber, that aircraft that he had just shot down was carrying Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto. But he did not know this. There were two Bettys in the flight. Barber then spotted the second Betty, and after Holmes, who had finally gotten his drop tanks dropped, attacked this Betty, Barber comes in. He pours more fire into this other Betty, which starts emitting smoke, and it too drops into the water, splashes in the water. This Betty is carrying Admiral Ugaki. Ugaki was Yamamoto's chief of staff. And again, Barber had no clue. You know, he's told to shoot down two Bettys. That's what he does. One of them's bound to be carrying Yamamoto. Of course, it was the first one.
So this one crashes in the water. Does Ugaki survive?
He does. He does. Ugaki winds up getting out. He's burned. He's cut up pretty bad, but he does get out of the bird, and he does, because you got to remember they're very, very close to shore. They're in the landing pattern. So, I mean, he's, you know, just a few hundred yards offshore. I don't even think he's a few hundred yards. He's like 150, 200 yards offshore. So he does make it to shore, and he does survive. He does survive this incident.
But each of the two Bettys are down now. So
yes.
Mission accomplished, right?
Exactly. And that's precisely what Mitchell says. He's up by now. He's achieved the altitude of about 18,000 feet. He's watching all this go down. When he watches that second Betty hit the water and go down, he gets on the radio and he says, quote, mission accomplished. Everybody get your ass home, unquote. Boom. And they break contact and they're gone. As fast as it started, it was over. And I mean, you know, just boom, 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 in, out, gone.
Yeah, we're talking maybe a minute here, I think.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Upon returning to Guadalcanal, Thomas Lanfear immediately, and I do mean like he puts the wheels down, he touches down at Kukum, shuts the engines off. Yeah, and he makes a beeline to the command post and says, I shot down Yamamoto, I'm putting in a claim for him. And for years, it was believed that Thomas Lanfear did indeed shoot down Yamamoto. Now, Rex Barber was fully aware that he shot down not one, but two, but both of those Betty bombers. Lanfear claimed and would go to his dying day saying that he shot down Isoroku Yamamoto. However, there were survivors from that Japanese escort flight. By the way, none of those Zeros were shot down. Lanfear also claimed a Zero that was shot down on that mission. It didn't go down. It was hit. It did not go down. That was common, though. That's not to say the man was a liar. It was common in dogfights. It happened quite a bit. Yeah. After the war, other members of the Yamamoto mission and the surviving Japanese looked at and heard what Lanfear was saying that he was doing in this mission, and they all, to a man, said he didn't do that. That was not how things went down.
Well, not only that, the Japanese went into the jungle to see if they could recover and rescue Admiral Yamamoto. And of course, he was dead.
Right.
And it was discovered that he'd been shot while still in the air through that left or, you know, rear quadrant, which is where Barber was firing from. So one of Barber's bullets struck Yamamoto while the airplane was still in the air. Actually, two of them did, and killed Yamamoto even before the plane crashed. They recovered Yamamoto's body. They documented where all the bullet holes were in the airplane. Mm-hmm. And that was further evidence that it was, in fact, Barber and not Lanfear who shot down the plane.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, and I don't know how much of the wreck is still visible today, but that Betty is still in the jungles today.
Yeah. In fact, I was planning a trip this year, which I unfortunately not going to be able to make. And one of the things I was going to do is go to Bougainville, and it's a bushwhack. It's, I think, maybe 7-8 kilometers through the jungle to find that airplane. But there's a lot of it's still there. Yamamoto's seat's no longer there.
Right.
They pulled that out when they pulled out his body and that of the other people that were killed. But the airplane's still there.
Yeah. Which is amazing when you think about it. To that end, the next day, the Japanese, to your point, Bill, they did go out there to go try and see if maybe, you know, by some slim miracle he had survived, or at the very least was, you know, badly wounded or whatever. And they find Yamamoto. He had been thrown clear of the airplane. He was still sitting in his seat, according to what the Japanese said. He was still clutching the handle of his katana. And his head was bowed down, and that's where they saw the bullet wounds. One had entered his left lower jaw. Yeah, he had one that come through his back, and another one entered his left lower jaw and exited through his right eye. So, I mean, and these are 50 caliber slugs. So, I mean, there's you're not coming out of that even, you know, no matter what.
No, I mean, dead instantly.
Oh, yeah. He was dead long before the plane ever hit the ground. You know, he was dead, as you said, instantaneously. The slain admiral's body was cremated per Japanese tradition, and his ashes were placed in a box. The box was poured aboard the battleship Musashi, the super battleship Musashi, which was in truck at that time. And Musashi carried Yamamoto's ashes and Admiral Ugaki. Now, true to the Japanese, they didn't want to admit that, you know, their CNC had just been killed. They didn't even tell the crew of the Musashi that you're bringing Yamamoto's body home. But it didn't take long. Bill, you've been on many a naval vessel. Word travels pretty dang fast. And it didn't take the crew long to figure something was up, because Yamamoto's cabin, or the admiral's cabin, you know, there was incense burning in there. Nobody was coming in and out. It was very evident that something was going. They'd seen the box with his ashes. They all knew what that box was. They didn't know who was in it, but by the time they got to Japan, they figured out who was in it.
It was in the admiral's stateroom. Duh.
Yeah. It was pretty evident who was in there. The Japanese reported the death of Yamamoto to the citizenry a little over a month later, May 22nd, 1943. His death had the exact prescribed effect on both the populace and the Navy. As the radio announcer for this radio station in Tokyo read the report, he broke down in tears. I mean, there were tens of thousands of people who turned out for his state funeral, which was held on June 5th, 1943, the 1 year anniversary of the Battle of Midway, by the way, because you got to remember Japan's on the other side of the international dateline. Yamamoto's ashes were then lowered into a grave, a freshly dug grave, and he's buried right next to Admiral Togo. So, I mean, this is a national hero, even today, in a lot of Japanese eyes.
Remember that he would get fan mail. He was a rock star before there was any such thing as a rock star. And he would answer the fan mail in his own hand.
Yeah.
And he would send his official portrait back to the writer of the fan mail. So he was beloved. And, you know, this, there was a lot of grieving that went on in Japan when they learned of his death.
Yep. And, you know, for the United States, the mission was a tremendous success. You know, it was a one fighter intercept mission, but it did everything that they wanted it to do. Hypo and Frumel again displayed their usefulness, and inter-service cooperation between the United States Army Air Forces, or the United States Army, however you want to look at it, and the U.S. Navy probably had never been better at this time. So much so that the Navy was so grateful to the Army pilots who shot down Yamamoto, they awarded them the Navy Cross, which is not something you hear of very often either.
Distinguished Service Cross, right?
Right.
So they could have been awarded the DSC, but the Navy said, no. You guys working for us, we're going to give you the Navy Cross. Mm-hmm. You still have the opportunity to earn the DSC at some future date.
Right. Of the killer group, only one casualty was of the group as a whole, only one casualty was sustained. Lieutenant Raymond K. Hine of the killer group, he's this late addition, he was killed in action. It is presumed that his 38 was jumped by escorting zero, by one of the escorting zero or multiple zeros, and shot down. At one point, I believe it was Barber, or it might have been Lanfear, I frankly don't recall, said they saw Hine's airplane emitting white smoke and that he was trying to get back with the group, and then he was never seen again. So he is the only American casualty on this mission. The Japanese, of course, lose Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto. To that point, Bill, we talked about it just briefly at the beginning. He was irreplaceable in the eyes of the Japanese, and his successor is a guy named Admiral Minichi Koga. And you'll hear a little bit about Koga as the Pacific War progresses, not too much, because he too gets lost in an airplane later on in the war. Koga, as opposed to Yamamoto, was significantly more conservative. Yamamoto was a gambler, literally a gambler. Like he loved to gamble. He loved to play poker. He was a gambler. And if you look at most of his actions in the Pacific War, Pearl Harbor, Midway, several of the attacks in Guadalcanal, they were gambles, you know, and he a lot of times threw caution to the wind and it came back to bite him in the butt. Koga was not that kind of a guy. And you will see, the listener, viewer, as we go through the rest of Koga's tenure as CNC, how, I don't want to say timid, but how conservative he was with deploying the Japanese combined fleet. He had opportunities to seek fleet battles with the United States Navy in 43 and early 44, but he did not. Yamamoto most certainly would have, in my opinion. Bill, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think it was the right thing to do. I think it achieved the intended effect. I think it revealed the lack of depth in Japanese naval leadership and, played out the way that leaders were hoping it would play out. So all these questions we asked at the beginning, was this the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? I think history has proven that it was the right thing to do.
I would agree. I think morally, you know, there was certainly some questions within it. But again, to our earlier point, you know, they'd have done the same thing to Admiral Nimitz and Halsey in a heartbeat, in an absolute heartbeat. They wouldn't have hesitated. But, you know, to the question that you posed earlier, Bill, and I think the listeners would like to hear us riff on this for just a minute or so. Was it good for the war effort on the United States part to kill Yamamoto, or was it bad? And I kind of, you know, of course, you'll never know. But the fact that Koga withheld the combined fleet from fleet actions when he had the opportunity in 43 and 44, whereas, in my opinion, Yamamoto would more than likely have committed those ships.
Yeah.
Therefore, we would have had the opportunity to destroy them sooner, because we would have. I mean, there's no doubt, you know.
By that time, we were starting to. The pendulum was swinging decisively in our favor.
Absolutely. Right. The Essex class were out there. You know, I mean, we had a tremendous Navy in 43 as opposed to 42. You know, a fleet action that would have been sought in 43 or early 44 would have been decisive in terms of we more than likely would have annihilated the Japanese fleet, which of course brings the question, would the war have ended sooner? Who knows? You know, who knows? I don't like to do a lot of what ifs, but who knows?
No. Well, in the unauthorized history of the Pacific War, we also like to correct, popular mythology when we encounter it. And one of my favorite movies dealing with the Pacific War is a movie called The Gallant Hours. Mm-hmm. And it's specifically focused on William F. Halsey. And interestingly, James Cagney plays Halsey in James Cagney's last ever leading role in a movie. And even more remarkably, James Cagney looks a lot like Halsey in this movie. It's almost scary how much he looks like Halsey. And even though it's a 1960 movie, when they were filming it, Halsey was still alive. He died shortly before the movie was released. And so Halsey took part in the research that went into the movie and in the filming of the movie. He actively participated. But this movie portrays the Yamamoto shootdown as happening concurrent with Guadalcanal in 42. Mm-hmm. That movie gets almost everything right. I think its best achievement is to reflect Halsey's personality more realistically than common cultural, you know, mythology. He's a more thinking human being in this movie, which I think is actually the way Halsey really was. He wasn't the outlandish buffoon that sometimes his own words may come out to be.
Right.
But in this movie, they move the timeline up of the Yamamoto shootdown to 42 to make it look like it was all Halsey.
Right.
It's Halsey's idea, Halsey's order, everything like that. And I regret that because the movie, in fact, I think it was one of the very first movies ever to be called a docudrama because it kind of feels like a documentary in many ways. It uses actual Navy World War II veterans for many of the actors in the movie. And it's so good in so many different ways. And it screws up this one thing. And it breaks my heart to think that Halsey was okay with it, to moving up the timeline from, you know, April 43 to, like, I think they put it in November of 42. So please watch the movie because it's so good.
It is.
But also please know that that didn't happen until months later.
Yeah. April 18th, 1943. When the mission was over, Halsey sent a message to Nimitz that basically said, yeah, we got him. And his final words in the message was April 18th is a good day for us. Because, of course, he's referring to a year earlier, which was, of course, a Doolittle raid, which he led the task force that delivered those B-25s. So
it launched the Doolittle raid. And, you know, it's funny because both of those were Army Air Forces aircraft.
Yep.
And I've seen a lot of the comments in our for the YouTube channel that say that the Doolittle raid was just symbolic. No, it wasn't. The Doolittle raid was a message to the Japanese that they were not outside the United States strike range. That is not symbolic. Right. That's real, right? Nor was this mission symbolic. Also an Army Air Force's mission, but it was not symbolic. They're both decisive in their own way, given the limited mission set that they were both achieved. And one other kind of footnote is that the guy who told the pilots who commanded Naval Air Forces in that area of the Pacific when this mission went down, who told the pilots who their target really was and probably violated security rules in doing it because it was supposed to be need to know only. And he decided that they needed to know, even though he didn't have the authority to decide that they needed to know, was Mark Mitcher. Why is that remarkable? This is the same Mark Mitcher who lied during the Battle of Midway a year earlier, and less than a year earlier, and who Nimitz gave a second chance to. And I think he's feeling pretty good about himself after this successful mission, knowing he's kind of doghouse with Nimitz.
He carves a path out, as we will see here as we continue to go through this history of this war. Mitcher does, but he does have some transgressions through his, or certainly the earlier part of his career that, you got to kind of wonder why he survived, frankly.
Yeah, the last thing I want to correct is part of the mythology of Yamamoto himself is there's this saying that's often associated with Yamamoto, which is, I fear we've awakened a sleeping giant, that Yamamoto is supposed to have said right after the attack on Pearl Harbor, a sleeping giant, of course, being the United States. Yamamoto never said those words. Those words were invented by a screenwriter for the movie Tora, Tora, Tora. Now, did Yamamoto, over the course of time, say things that kind of sound like that? In as much as he knew that we needed to win quickly, they needed to win quickly, or things would not go well for them, he kind of expressed that sentiment, but he never said those words. And I wrote an article about a month ago that was published in the Hill newspaper, where I titled my article, "Who's the Sleeping Giant Now?" And of course, I opened the article with the phrase that Yamamoto never made, which is, right, I fear we've awakened a sleeping giant. And I say in the article, he didn't actually say those words, but he should have, is the way I opened the article. Now, the point of making that article is, all those things that Yamamoto said about the United States in 1919, 1920, 21, about the industrial might, are now true for China. And so my point is, who's the sleeping giant now? A single one of China's shipyards has the same capacity as all 20 American shipyards put together. So China is the sleeping giant now. And the United States, if our lawmakers don't understand that and do something about it to help us recover, then there's going to be some American in some future war saying the thing that Yamamoto was accused of saying in the movie Tora, Tora, Tora. And that's kind of the point of my article. But it comes to mind as we talk about Yamamoto today.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a very good point. It's all 100% valid, too. Well, Bill, do you have anything else you want to throw in here about the Yamamoto raid?
No, I think it's an important, more than a footnote of history of the Pacific, but less than an inflection point. It's important to understand from a historical standpoint what happened and to learn from it. And to give credit where credit is due to the code breakers and to the Army Air Force's pilot who executed it flawlessly, and to learn the lessons as well. And because this could easily have gone south. Yep. And, who knows what would have happened if it did.
Yeah, and not a tide turning event, as some of the other events we've talked about, but important nonetheless, for the weight that it carried on the Japanese morale, American morale, and the future prosecution of the war from both sides. The death of Yamamoto caused a lot of chain reaction events that you're going to see here over the next several episodes until the end of the war. So with that, we want to thank you very much for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast wherever you receive your podcasts. Give us a rating and review. We do appreciate it. Also, as always, if you want to watch us instead of listening to us, look at our YouTube channel, Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. And also do us a favor. Please like and subscribe to the channel. We're seeing a ton of views, and we love that. We appreciate that greatly. But when you like and subscribe to our channel, it helps the algorithm get our channel out to other people. So in order for other people to find us by clicking that like button and clicking that subscribe button, that helps us out. So we do appreciate that if you do it. And if you haven't, please do so. If you have a question, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. And once again, my name is Seth Perdon. I want to say thank you very much, Bill.
And I'm Bill Toady. I'm glad to be back and see you next week.
See you soon. Bye.